Welcome to the Bicycle Media Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the health of the cycling industry.
Not a lot of people had that tone that just said, ride whatever bike you want to ride.
Try and really focus and make sure the rider has a great experience.
There's a couple of things about building a custom bike.
What these e-bikes can do.
The customer just wouldn't take no for an answer kind of thing.
So I think in a way we're in a sweet spot where we don't have all this stuff tying us down.
We just discussed about making the cycling industry more welcoming for women.
The bike mechanic was right there on the floor.
Something that Weir has really done well in the last couple of years is driven by rock and roll.
It's quite hard for them to train when they don't know what they're training for.
Since again, we believe that our bodies are very smart.
We definitely tend to look forward a lot more.
I started to demystify things.
But if you don't have the right staff, that's game over.
You're not selling at that point, you're educating.
Our intent is to educate both motorists and cyclists.
So we're back with another episode, Bicycle Media Podcast. And this one is with the owner, founder of Abbey Bike Tools, Jason Quaid. And on the Pro Circuit Bike Mechanics, all have his tools. One or another, they've got something within the Abbey Bike Tools catalog. But more importantly is, just like the Rodeo Adventure Labs DNA, the brand is super important and the integrity of the brand is, you know, evident in the product. So Jason talks a little bit about the first tool that was ever made, just sort of a request from a friend, but he goes into his own background as both a welder and a professional bike mechanic to build some pretty cool stuff that's meant to be light. It's super strong and superior with a lifelong warranty. So I'm going to let him do all the talking. He's a super cool guy. Very great to chat with him. Love all of his tools, as many of us do. So here's my chat with Jason Quaid of Abbey Bike Tools. For those of us not familiar with Abbey Tools, can you give us a little bit of a breakdown on, you know, certainly your career as a mechanic and the antithesis of Abbey Tools to where it is now?
Definitely started working at bike shops while I was in high school. And that kind of ran its course, moved to Oklahoma, to go to welding school, thinking that that was going to be my approach to like, oh, well, I can, like, here's a trade and a skill that I can learn, that's can be applied to, you know, hundreds of different industries, including the bicycle industry. That was still when Trek and Cannondale a few others all those people were manufacturing domestically. So it seemed like something that was reasonably viable at the time in the early 2000s. Got out of school, went to work building pressure vessels for power plants, massive, huge industrial stuff. It was big, big. We had train tracks running through each of our three bays in the shop that kind of put it to scale. So we had 150 ton cranes, and we built heat exchangers from everything from like old school coal plants to nuclear grade pressure vessels. So kind of cool to have some of that experience in the background, and it makes what I do now, like they seem very childish in scale, just because like, hey, now there's, you know, a dozen of these things will fit in my hand. And at that first job, like everything had to get moved around with a forklift or a crane. Like there was no pretending we were going to pick these things up, even in their smallest pieces. So, then we got married when I lived in Oklahoma under the pretense that we would not stay in Oklahoma. Wife and I moved out to Bend, Oregon and for her job, bounced around a little bit in the aviation industry. When the private aviation that I was involved with, kind of light personal aircraft, was kind of the first thing to get whacked by a little bit of a stall of the economy, but before the recession hit. So that's when I went back to work in the bike industry, ran a service department of a shop here in town. And, got reinvigorated with bicycles. And they weren't the toys out here on the West Coast like they were growing up in the Midwest. So, definitely kind of took that back and filtered into doing a lot of event and race support, when that job ended, because there was literally like almost nothing else to do, employment wise. And then, kind of started making tools on accident when Jeff Crombie, asked me to make that lock ring tool, and, seemed like a pretty good idea. And it took probably about two years to kind of make that shift emotionally and just kind of calculate like, hey, there's an actual business here as opposed to this kind of freelance, race mechanic thing that I've been doing. And so, yeah, then we just kind of took off, and that was 8 years ago. So, yeah, been good.
In an interview you did, you know, you said that you don't really build tools that need to be compromised, that you build the best tools you can, and if they wind up being expensive, that's great. They just are never going to be full of compromises. And nowadays, now that you've got a full catalog of tools, how do you decide what tools to build, or more importantly, what problems to solve?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely tend to look forward a lot more than we do look back at legacy tools. So, you know, a few times a year, we'll get people that'll ask us to make square taper crank pullers. Like, I own that tool. It's somewhere buried in a drawer of a toolbox, and I probably haven't used it in 10 or 12 years. And I realize that some people still use that tool, you know, 5 or 6 times a day. But the reality of it is that there's a lot of those crank pullers out there, and most of the people that need to own them already own them. So you kind of look at it as the, you know, we're better off putting the time and energy into manufacturing a new tool for a new series of product than we are something that's legacy. That's, you know, hey, there's 200 company, or there's, you know, 20 different companies that make crank pullers. And, you know, and they've been making them exactly the same way for decades. Now, I have thought about making crank pullers, and I'm like, there's definitely some things here that we could do slightly better. But at the same time, like, it's not, I don't know, it's not super high on the list, right? So, but yeah, that's kind of one of the things. I mean, sometimes we, you know, most of the tools I would say in our product range started as like custom things for a particular person. So the Crombie tool was a great example. Like, that, when Jeff asked me to make that tool, there was no, like, I mean, I made it in my garage. It's pretty low tech and a little crude. I've got some photos of it somewhere if you wanted to see. I need to throw them up on the social media just because it's kind of a cool run back through memory lane to some extent. But so yeah, they kind of start as things that are made for a particular person. And the suspension top cap sockets were another example of that, where a factory tech at Fox actually wanted to see those made, like, purpose-built sockets. And the people at Fox told him, that's silly. Like, you should never make tools out of aluminum. Like, they won't work. They won't hold up. And so when he got shot down internally, he came to me, because we'd known each other for years, and I was like, yeah, we can do that. And actually, there's a whole host of things we can do that could be better if we're going to actually make this thing from scratch. And so we did all those things, and we kind of created this little subcategory, and now there's 4 or 5 different companies that make purpose-built or kind of scratch-built sockets for suspension, including Fox. So it was kind of funny, like, they pushed back. We're this small agile company. We were willing to roll the dice on some of that stuff and listen to these people that are specialists. And, you know, we put something out there, and then everybody's like, huh, okay, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. So, you know, sometimes I feel like we're the R&D department of the bicycle tool manufacturers, because there's so many times where we see things. A lot of times they're really little and subtle, and I may be the only person or one of a couple of people that notice them. And sometimes it's really blatant when somebody takes a tool design from us and kind of, you know, maybe puts a certain color stripe on it and calls it their own. And but yeah, that was a hard pill to swallow the first time it happened. Unfortunately, it's happened enough for me to somewhat come to terms with it. So
maybe we can go into just, again, a couple of things where the industry at large is affecting your design. And so just looking at the Decade chain tool, but where I want to go with this question is, I understand that you recently added an adaptable mid plate. There was maybe a product in the market that required you to be a little more flexible. I think it was the SRAM Axis Road Chain. Can you talk about how the industry's component designs affect versions of your tools, perhaps?
Yeah, so it's a little interesting, like, being the tool maker, because we typically are the monkey in the middle. So you've got a component manufacturer in this, you know, or a series of them manufacturing chains. And then we have to kind of service those chains and connect them to the user, right? So we go from people's hands to the task at hand, and we have these other variables to deal with. So the first kind of pre-production beta batch of chain tools did not have that replaceable bid plate. And because of the relationship that we had with SRAM, we had a couple of people that kind of came to us and said, hey, you know, what are you, you know, just kind of casually, what are you working on? And I was like, well, you know, the next thing is like, I kind of want to do a chain tool. And I see the eyes light up and they're like, you should talk to somebody about that at SRAM. And I'm like, who? And they're like, I don't know, I've already said too much. And so I was like, all right, well, there's something big here. So I kind of go through the process, and this was probably 2.5 years before the new, or kind of the current Axis Red Group, so the came out. And so they're pretty far out, and they're understandably keeping their cards close to the chest. And for whatever reason, like, we couldn't kind of, they chose not to make, to disclose that information to us. And, you know, they've got product development, intellectual property and that stuff. And I totally respect that, but it kind of forced I was like, man, the last thing that I want to do is make a new chain tool and have them come out with something that makes our tool obsolete. Maybe I've got, you know, several thousand dollars worth of inventory sitting on here that nobody wants to buy because it won't work with this new thing, regardless of how small it is. And so that's when we kind of came up with, you know, we started looking at the kind of the computer models and realizing that, you know, all the compatibility is the thickness of that little saddle that the chain sits in and its spacing to the backstop. And then there were also some manufacturing challenges about how do we make that thin, deep slot between those two parts, between the mid plate and the backstop of the chain stool, which is kind of a challenging thing in manufacturing to do kind of very narrow, deep features like that, if they're not like just drilled holes. And so then we kind of had this aha moment of, well, let's just bolt that part in there. And then we get rid of this feature that's challenging to make. And then it also gives us all this ability to make this thing whatever it needs to. So yeah, it was, you know, and then we launched the tool at Eurobike, I think in 2018. I might have to check that date, but, you know, and then we start shipping them in later in that fall. We had a key vendor in that one have two different machines catch fire, which caused a huge setback. You know, but and thankfully all the customers were super understanding. You know, we just tried to communicate as much as we could with people that had orders and then just kind of making some general PSAs on social media about the delays. And thankfully everybody, you know, was fine. I don't think we had a single person cancel an order because of, you know, us kind of blowing by our estimated ship date. But yeah, so all that kind of went down. And then I think by the end of the year, we'd sold out of that first batch. We're making more. And then January, February, like, we get news that SRAM's doing a big product launch thing down in Arizona, I think. And then it's like within 6 months of us shipping our first tool, they turn around and validate that design decision to, you know, to make that thing interchangeable, the mid plate interchangeable, so that we can, you know, it's like, hey, yeah, we don't work with this, you know, but like, I'll have parts ready in a month, you know, which normally would be plenty of, like, those parts wouldn't be hitting store shelves, but SRAM really nailed that product launch and was like, hey, here's this brand new stuff. It's at distributors. It's at bike shops. You can go purchase it now, which is definitely is a great way to do it. Unfortunately, I think we got some feedback that maybe that wasn't so hot because these critical tools weren't available. So yeah, that kind of made it a little challenging. But yeah, it was great to validate that stuff. You know, that key decision. We've got another piece of chain from a chain manufacturer that's kind of going to prove that story again for us here, probably before the year is out. So, you know, unless somebody does something super weird, like does a different pitch. So like right now, chains are all half inch pitch, roller to roller. If they did something drastically different there, maybe we wouldn't be able to adapt to that. But if somebody would have to do something really, really crazy and out there for us to not be able to work with that. But yeah, it's kind of a, you know, and the big thing there too is that we knew that the chain tool wasn't going to be inexpensive, right? And so people are way more reluctant to buy high quality tools if they know that the compatibility around them is likely to change. And so I think that it was a big deal that people saw us being able to adapt to whatever the industry throws at us in supporting that stuff. And then like, okay, well now I have way more confidence to buy this tool at, you know, $150 plus, even just north of $100, you know, because they can adapt it, they can update it for a pretty nominal cost relative to the price of the tool, and know that, you know, have some confidence in us that we're going to support that product and the interfacing products being the chains, you know, for the foreseeable future as long as we're in business. So
I'll move into the new video series that looks at the, you know, the usage and then the manufacturing process for the Harbor Dishing Gauge. And I think that's important because people probably underestimate the craftsmanship that goes into it. We've in the past had a custom titanium frame builder who's got ultrasonic clean welds. I've seen his shop. It is for what it is. You know, it's a shop, but it's surgically clean. It is absolutely pristine. Do you think people underestimate what goes into not just the design? I mean, you talked about going from the computer screen to, let's say, the mechanics toolbox, that whole process. But do you think people underestimate, once the design is set, the manufacturing process and ensuring that quality is important?
Very much so. I think, I mean, so just to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of how tight-knit our manufacturing circle is, like we have one vendor that's out there in 25 minutes of our shop. We're looking at purchasing a new piece of equipment that actually will allow us to make about 95% of our parts in-house, whereas right now it's about 30 or 40%. So, so manufacturing is at least half the battle. Like, design gets so much credit, but it's really just the start of the process, right? And it kind of lays the roadmap for everything else, but there's so many times when we, like the dishing tool was an example, and talk about that video. Like, it was, we battled back and forth on that thing depending on how we were going to make it. So I probably had 6 different solid models that were kind of, you know, not fully fleshed out, but like, well, if we're going to cast it, here's how we could do it. If we're going to do like a tube structure and weld and like weld tubing to machine parts and stuff, like here's how we could do that. And then, you know, we start looking at how much time it's going to take to do those things in man hours. And then it was like, you know what, if we put a 26-pound billet of material into the CNC machine, we can press that green button and come back in 2 hours and the thing's like 70% done. And so then it was, you know, but yeah, manufacturing is huge. You know, inside or outside of our door, a lot of it, you know, comes down to quality control. You've got those specifications, those tolerances, where do they need to lie? How accurate are they? And then some of the things that we make are really difficult to measure. So you look at like the bottom bracket sockets and that weird spline pattern, like, you know, that's kind of a tough one to measure with normal hand tools. And so we've, you know, as we've evolved, we've built custom gauging to be able to slide, you know, part like the negative, basically. The into and out of that part. And it's like those things are, we basically have a go, one that has to fit and one that can't fit. And the difference between those things is only about 0.02 of an inch, which is like 0.07 millimeters. I'd have to double check that conversion, but yeah, it's not a whole lot, but that's kind of the standard feature that we hold on our tool interfaces. You know, just so that they fit really tight and accurately. But yeah, I mean, I'd say that the manufacturing process is definitely drives a lot of what we do. We definitely think of ourselves as a manufacturing oriented company. you know, and it's, and yeah, design's just kind of the start. And it's an ebb and flow. I mean, where the design work happens is literally like 30 feet away, from the machines that they get made on, if they're going to be a CNC part. Like, so yes, it's a very fluid thing. There's things that change all the time. Even once we get to the machine, it's like, oh, we can't, like that hole is going to be really challenging, or like that radius needs to be just a little bit bigger, or a little bit smaller. It's like, all right, well, let's just go change it. It's not this big, you know, this big overarching process where we have to, like, you know, design or like go through an engineering request change, or, you know, all those things that can be super cumbersome in a big organization. And for good reason, like, you don't want guys on the shop floor just, you know, arbitrarily changing a feature because it's difficult to make when it truly is critical. But the flip side of that is that a lot of that stuff's not critical. And you could, you know, maybe make those design tweaks, so that they are easier to make, and that the, you know, or you get better life out of the tools that you're using to make them.
Something that is, again, truly innovative. Again, I'm now going to switch gears to the bearing press and the split nut. That is an absolute time saver. But I look at that split nut and I think, wow, what a game changer. Can you talk about the aha moment when that thing came off, sort of the assembly line for the first time, and folks gave you feedback?
Yeah, no, that one, I have a friend of mine, Matt Smith, here in town, who's kind of a product development engineer. And he's when I hit a wall, he's somebody that I go chat to. And it was funny because I still remember sitting in his office, and we're like kind of drawing things on the whiteboard and talking about other things that are kind of similar in industry that work. And I was like, I just started sketching things out, and it was definitely like the idea popped out of my head, but it's funny how certain people just like ask the right questions or enable you to, you know, to lead you in a direction, to come up with something that I'd been thinking about for weeks. It's a very simple part in kind of on the surface. It is the most challenging and time-consuming part that we manufacture. It's pretty rough, and there's some very, like, they're a little finicky. But the end result is something that works super well, and saves a ton of time. It eliminates that pinch hazard that some of the other presses have. That, you know, when you talk to, anytime you show that to a kind of a career mechanic, they're like, oh, I've gotten the web between my thumb and my index finger caught in that clasp on, you know, Brand X's press for, you know, a dozen times. It hurts so bad. And it's like, yeah, ours doesn't do that. Cause guess what? I've had that happen too.
So folks out there, if you have your press, respect your split nut. It is the most demanding thing in Jason's production line. I'll move into the toolbox. Were you surprised with the demand when you fired it up and went to production?
Yeah, I mean, we did, totally blown away. Our expectations on new products tend to be pretty modest. That one we were modest with, but I think we exceeded kind of our modest expectations about fivefold, to kind of just, I don't know, put things out there. But one of our ambassadors, Drew Hartman, that owns a shop called On Your Left in Louisville, Kentucky, had been pushing on me to do toolkits for about as long as I'd known him, 5-6 years. And I always kind of pushed back on toolkits because seeing how other people do them, I wasn't excited about it. I didn't see value in putting, like, going and getting some open mold set of pliers or a screwdriver or something and sticking them into a kit just so that they could be our signature color. You know, or having to settle for some cut rate plier instead of putting the pliers wrench in there that, you know, everybody sees in the pit walk galleries from, you know, race, regardless of discipline. Like, that's kind of become a ubiquitous tool. And it's because it's amazing. I mean, we've probably got 6 pairs scattered around the shop at different workstations. And so then we, and then kind of the popularity of the toolbox wars thing that really just kind of started as a joke, and it's really kind of just grown so far beyond that. People loved all of that kind of super organization stuff, and then we kept getting so many questions about like, hey, can I buy this? Can I buy this? It's like, no, all these toolkits are, they're all custom and they're for the person. Like, you have to have the fun, and the challenge is going to build your own. I was kind of like, well, you know what, like, let's talk to KnipX. And we already had a relationship with Wera, because we use their bits in our little four-way tools. And so we went to them, and then we went to like, all right, well, like, and what are the things that other kits miss, right? Like, I don't know if anybody else does a bicycle marketed toolkit that includes a tape measure or a flashlight. And it's like, those are two tools in my toolbox that I definitely could not live without. So it's like, all right, we went to Starrett and got these really rad, like metric Imperial, tape measures. They just kind of have a nice spring and a nice snap to them. They're kind of the right length for bike use. Pelican, does a pretty solid range of flashlights. And so we went with their case and we sourced flashlights from them. Next thing we know, we had this kit that, like, I felt pretty flushed out about. And to back up just a second, the other thing that kind of drove me nuts about prepackaged kits is that there was never enough room to add things on. It's like, you might be able to squeeze a little tool or two in there, but the reality is it like, we nor any other tool manufacturer, honestly, like, manufacture 100% of what you're going to need to put in there. Right. There's always, you're always going to want to have spare parts, a derailleur hanger, a little bolt bin, things like that, a bleed kit or a specific suspension tool that you need for your line of work. And so that's why we left that bottom layer open, right? Like, you can cut out and do your own, carve your own bins in there. You can pull the whole thing out and put just one big spare parts bins, like some of the factory techs that wind up, you know, carrying around a lot of little bits and bobs for, you know, supporting stuff that they need to be the person at the event that has those little things, because the other team mechanics are going to come like, hey, I need like that weird screw for that dropper C post. Right. And it's like, you know, and then they roll their eyes. They're like, why couldn't we have put a normal bolt in here that, you know, anybody could have, or you could find at the hardware store, but it's like, nope, now I have to haul that stuff around, for when that tech needs it. So, yeah, I mean, we left the empty space in the bottom. That was kind of, I don't know, we put it together with, like I said, with pretty modest expectations, and then kind of completely blew past them. So I think the laser touches that we did on the outside of the box to kind of make that pop, but not in a way that's super flashy. And then the custom name tags, like all that stuff, to add a little bit of a personal touch. So we've gotten some great feedback on those. And at this point, like, it's in the product range for the foreseeable future.
Podcast is caffeinated by Roasty Coffee Company, a small batch coffee roaster and cafe in Short Park, Alberta. They now offer free home delivery in the Edmonton area and free shipping Canada-wide on orders over $36. Check them out at roasty.ca. That's roasty.ca, and order yourself some. So thanks, guys, for keeping us caffeinated.
It's kind of funny. You've left these open spaces. And I know Joel will be listening to this podcast. He said, Cody, those things are the hardest things to fill, because every time I think I know what I want to put in them, I think, I don't want to risk cutting the foam. I got to be ready. So all across the world where these boxes are, you've created a good thing and a nice mental challenge for everybody. The four-way, I think, is a staple. I know Brad Copeland says on race day they're in his pockets. And I think that is an ode to your brand and your craftsmanship. And so I'll move a little bit into brand, because brand is, I liken it to a castle made out of playing cards. Brand is the reputation of a company or a person, but it has fragility to it. So I just want to start and give our listeners a little sense of your awesomeness when it comes to brand. I'm just going to read the quote from your website and just get you to talk a little bit about it. It says, tools matter. They build things and are pivotal to the manufacturing and assembly of pretty much everything. Our professional tools help talented craftsmen elevate the bike mechanic trade, a trade that needs elevating. Can you talk a little bit about that? And certainly the last part of that statement, a trade that needs elevating?
Yeah, I mean, it took me a little while to kind of come to terms, like, I don't know, realize all the things that toolmakers can do. And not too long ago, I kind of came to the realization that it was, it's kind of the center of the world, right? Like, society's only as good as the tools that we have to build it with. And it touches virtually everything, outside of like, philosophers and maybe like comics or people that just have straight visual interpretive art. So, but the flip side of it is that it's the one thing that pretty much everybody can be involved with. It's so ubiquitous and so universal that, you know, whether you're doing a custom spreadsheet pivot table thing, like my business partner John takes care of all that stuff, thankfully. Those are tools that are very important to us. And then we also have these tangible things that we think of as tools. It's a pretty cool part of the industry to be in. We definitely kind of started out, when I told Jeff, Crombie, I was like, you know, it was a, like, I just had an idea for a hole. That was really literally as simple as our first tool was. It's like we drilled a hole where nobody had ever drilled it. But the thing that really built a business around that was the execution of quality, which looking back on it was something that the bicycle industry as a whole was really lacking in our specific category. So everybody else had kind of exploded in their level of performance and their execution. From wheel manufacturers to drivetrain, all the frame manufacturers that just kind of crept up their quality level pretty drastically from when I started working in the bike industry in the late 90s. But the tool manufacturers didn't really follow suit. And so that's kind of where we were able to, it's like, I like shiny things. Like, I like building nice things. Like, let's just do this how I want to. And the first 100 tools, and way more than the first 100, but like the first batch of Crombie tools, I still see photos of them on social media every once in a while. I'll see them in a race mechanics box when I was still traveling. And it was like, that's an old one. Like, and I know all the little differences. Right. And it's cool to see that they're still going strong, but it really was a level of quality that kind of put, that we built the business around, and we matched what everybody else, like what the other component manufacturers and whatnot were doing. People were just really ready for that, I think is what allowed us to kind of get our feet under us and learn all these other things about running a business that weren't related to the product and the manufacturing. And kind of to get back onto the branding thing, like everybody always says that authenticity is the biggest thing there, and they're always chasing that authenticity. And it's like, I think if you're chasing it, you're doing it wrong. Like it's either super authentic and it's really easy for you to say and be who you really are and just kind of throw it out there. I think when you have people that aren't as, they're more branding, marketing driven, but they're not your customer, that's when things get more challenging. And some of those people do a great job of building those brands, when they're not the customer. For us, it's been me. There's four of us at Abbey, and it's definitely, I don't know, it's, I'm still kind of very much the center of it as the founder and the kind of the owner, and the floor sweeper and the welder and the machinist and all the other things. But it definitely, I don't know, you just kind of, you be straight with people. Part of the thing that's definitely unique about our customer base is that they're the most surly people in the bike industry, right? Like we build tools for professional mechanics and they're quick to call bullshit. Or say that something's not holding up or that we're just kind of pulling all these marketing buzzwords out of our butt and just, oh, this is super bespoke or it's like it's handcrafted or, these are made out of aerospace, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you know, that's a particularly funny one. It's like, are we talking about the aluminum alloy that the beverage cart is made out of? That comes down and you get your overpriced beer off of and your bag of peanuts? Are we talking about like the alloy that the landing gear is made out of? Because, you know, one of those things is way more important than the other. And they're two very different things. So, you know, it's almost, I mean, we do posts kind of tongue in cheek every once in a while to kind of poke fun at that stuff. But having worked in aviation and a little bit in the nuclear power world, like, there are things that, like, yeah, those, they're just certified. There's more paperwork that comes with those things. Like, it's not, nobody that claims that they're building, you know, from aerospace alloys, like, they're not buying the $100 packet of paperwork that goes with that material to make it a truly certified batch of material, right? Like it may come from the same heat number, but it doesn't come with the same paperwork. And that's really the big difference with that stuff. So, there's kind of the branding story. And then as far as like the second half of that question to be the, kind of a segment of the industry that needs elevating. Like there's a lot of bike mechanics that are good, that are great, that have devoted their life to it. And it's great to see our tools in their hands. You know, I think that they've kind of been our foundation, regardless of what their discipline is from day one. You know, whether they're traveling the world, working at races, or whether they're, you know, working out of a shipping container in Southern, you know, in San Diego County, like doing their own little thing, or mobile repair guys like this. So all those people are great to see, but the barrier to entry is super low, in to be a bike mechanic. And we've all benefited from that. If you've done that as an occupation, it was relatively easy to get a job. I mean, you hang around a bike shop long enough as a kid or a young adult, you know, and sooner or later they're going to start kicking you some spare parts and whatnot to take out the trash or the cardboard and, you know, go do lunch runs or whatever they can put you to work on. But, you know, and then when you start to get into it, that standard of quality just unfortunately isn't there, which is something that I wish, you know, we could kind of fast forward our business 10 years and have somebody in the resources to, like, you know, really get behind and support some of those efforts that, like, the Pro Bike Mechanics Association has done, or Quality Bicycle Products has you know, done their mechanic trainings. We do try to work with all the schools, Barnett's, United Bicycle Institute that's here in Oregon. And then I think it's Appalachia Bike. Jenny, I know, is the proprietor there, but out east runs a small bike training school. But yeah, there's not a whole lot of foundation for people that want to learn that stuff. And then even if they do, there's the pay range isn't quite there. Like, it doesn't necessarily justify anything over on the job training or whatnot. And, you know, you might see in my personal career, I maybe saw like a $7 an hour swing from where I started to where I was running a service department over the span of about 15 years. And I kind of floated in and out of the bike industry and did some other things. So it wasn't, and there were three or four different shops in there. But I mean, that wasn't to kind of go from the bottom entry level position to running a 3-person service department. You know, that was at a reasonably high end shop, like the kind of shop that doesn't stock kickstands, to give you an idea. Like, you know, it felt like a pretty nominal amount of money, for something that I was regarded for being pretty good at. And I'm sure that if that shop wouldn't have gone out of business, I maybe, you know, could be making significantly more money if I was still there. But the reality is that the ceiling's just only so high. So I don't know what truly the answer is. I saw a press release from another organization trying to get a training curriculum program that was kind of college level off the ground this last week or this week. And you know, best of luck to them. I need to reach out to them just to see, you know, to kind of offer some support and see if there's anything that we can help with. But Yeah, I mean, I don't, with retailers and shops being forever pinched and trying to feel like they need something to be sustainable, like, I don't know what the answer is. Like, I would love for everybody to just do everything the best way with the right tooling, with the right attitude to do things, you know, to do things really well. But at the same time, like, how realistic is it to sink that kind of a capital investment into your staff on a training standpoint, or, you know, and then to pay them more afterwards.
Our listeners and even yourself might not be a fan of his music, but Neil Young, I'm going to talk a little bit about something that reminds me of you and your brand.
Okay.
And I'm going to compare you to Neil Young, if I might. So I was
probably the first and only time that this will happen that I get compared to Neil Young.
Yeah. So it's now on record. It's being recorded. So here I am, Nashville, Tennessee. I'm at a goalie coaching conference. That's my other vocation, professional goalie coach. There I was at the Music Hall of Fame. And as you go through this tour, you take a little video before you go in to see this Music Hall of Fame. And I'll never forget it. Again, I have a background in music. I graduated as a jazz drummer, was a music producer and everything. And here is Neil Young. And here's what it reminds me of. He said, it's cool to be famous and to be a, you know, a star, but it's better to be labeled as somebody's favorite musician. And that's a pride that he had. You know, when Neil Young said it, it's better to be known as somebody's favorite musician. In fact, he said, it's the absolute highest compliment you can give somebody. That guy's one of my favorite musicians. And so Abby's one of my favorite tools would be sort of the equivalent, I think, for the pro bike mechanic. I'm just going to close here. In a couple of days from now, you will be on day two of Reveal. It's a global media conference. Are you excited for that? I obviously don't want to have you force you to give any spoilers, but is that something where, you know, the conferences have gone virtual, and are you happy for something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's I am looking forward to it more, just, or I guess as much of a curiosity as anything else. You know, it's like the guys, the crew at Echoes, definitely kind of, you know, created this event out of nothing, you know, as a response to everything that's going on in the world right now, and the inability to, you know, to go gather in places. Sea Otter traditionally is such a massive event, and it's one of my favorites, because in Bend, Oregon, this time of year is typically one of the hardest to live here, because we don't really get a spring. It's kind of this war between winter and summer.
Hey, I'm in Alberta.
I was going to say, I'm sure as a Canadian, you're all too familiar with this concept, but, yeah, so, it is, so yeah, I like going down there to just see some sunshine and not have to wear a coat. But, yeah, so I'm excited just because it's so different. I'm kind of curious to see where the trade show spectrum goes after, like, in the wake of this year, because so many other people have done these virtual outreaches and stuff. And I know on our side, like, we haven't really seen, sales numbers don't look that different from years past, which is great. But, you know, it's like, we've spent a lot less money so far this year in terms of, like, every trade show that's normally pretty significant expenses, they haven't happened. And so it's like, huh, do they need to happen? Like, you kind of like start scratching your chin and wondering, like, huh, I wonder. So yeah, that's kind of, as much as I like, you know, the FaceTime is irreplaceable, right? But when you look at how the media world works, and to see all those guys scrambling, they're like, whoa, this was a massive source of content for us, and we need to get on replacing this. So yeah, and I'll be interested to see where we are 2 or 3 years from now, kind of what we were forced to do this year, and then what we'll do when it's an option to have those events again. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We do have a couple of new products that are a little more shop focused, that we'll be dropping on that conference next week. So yeah.
I'm going to be tuned in both days. We'll wrap up with just how you can follow Abby Bike Tools. How can people learn more about you guys and stay in tune with what's going on? And how can people learn more about what you guys are going to launch?
Yeah, so we're at Abby Bike Tools on all social media platforms. We're doing a little, trying to focus this year on doing some more YouTube content, some instructional stuff. how-to things, some key features that, you know, make our tools a little better than some of the, or a lot better than some of the competition out there, kind of fit some things that may not be super apparent from static photos. Get me in front of a camera talking too much, probably. But yeah, so looking forward to doing more of the video stuff. And
Jason, this was really cool to speak with you, and I'm glad we were able to get some time. We're recording late April 2020, where folks have had perhaps some more time than normal, but I know you're slammed and super busy, so I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no, you know, it's always good to sit down and chat about these things. It definitely lets us look back and reflect a little bit when we have to explain these things to fresh people, fresh set of ears.
Big thanks to Jason for his time. Always looking forward to seeing what they roll out for new tools and certainly adding more to my toolbox. But again, that story of sticking true to your brand and uncovering a need for what's already there. Up next, we have Irish cyclist Imogen Cotter. She's going to talk a little bit about how she transitioned from being a runner into cycling through a program called a Talent Transition Program, to then sitting on the podium just a couple years later for the Nationals Irish Nationals. So pretty cool person, definitely somebody who uses her collegiate background, her university education with Bachelor of Science. So looking forward to that episode. Again, continue to subscribe on all the major platforms, send in your feedback. And again, check out Bicycle Media on all our social platforms. See what we're up to. Send us a message. If you need support with your email marketing, your website, anything to do with social media, search marketing, definitely love to chat a little bit more and get working with you guys. So stay tuned for the next episode. Hope all is well. Talk to you next time.